Welcome to another edition of Raising Sand Radio. I'm your host, Susan Gallimore, with the South African group Four Jacks and Jill, with the Lion Serenade from the album Escape to Africa to introduce our show today. We will do something a little different during our hour today and talk with a naturalist, herpetologist, conservationist, and former game warden in Africa. Garth Carpenter currently rescues injured and wounded animals, and if it is possible to do so, rehabilitates them back to the wild. His small organization, called the Ashburton Sanctuary, is located outside the KwaZulu-Natal city of Pietermaritzburg in a conservancy area. It is my great pleasure to air this conversation with Garth Carpenter, as he has dedicated his life to conserving wild animals and wild places, and he will talk about those beginnings here today. Moreover, as a young girl of about 12 or so, I accompanied Garth Carpenter on some of his excursions to collect snakes and other creatures when they were, according to their human counterparts, making a nuisance of themselves. One wonders what those wild creatures thought of the humans making a nuisance of themselves in their wild places and spaces. At any rate, I visited Garth Carpenter at his Ashburton Sanctuary and conducted this field recording from his office. You will hear some of the sounds that surround the Ashburton Sanctuary, including dogs barking and birds chirping, and I hope that these sounds present an opportunity to understand what it is people like Garth Carpenter are trying to preserve with their work, and in this case, with the Ashburton Sanctuary. We begin with how Garth Carpenter got started and in fulfilling his life's work and his destiny.
I've been doing it now since the age of 12.
Wow.
And last year, during the summer months, I got over 200 calls for snakes. And those are snakes in gardens, houses, outbuildings, motor cars. And I'm still very, very active in that field.
And so we're near Pietermaritzburg, which is in KwaZulu-Natal province. What kind of snakes are you getting called to pick up?
Okay, in our area, we have the African rock python, which I normally get calls for when they're in poultry houses or that type of thing, or eating a sheep somewhere, and you know, you go out and fetch them. We've got black mambas in the area, Mozambique spitting cobras, worm slung, puff adders, night adders. All these are venomous snakes. Mm. And then we have 34 harmless snakes in the area.
Wow.
Like house snakes and spotted bush snakes and snakes like that. But the main problem ones are the pythons, mambas, cobra, puff adders, worm slung, and
Is the Mozambique spitting cobra similar to the ringhals?
Well, the ringhals has the characteristics of the Mozambique spitting cobra. But the ringhals is not a true cobra. True cobras, of which we've got four in South Africa, that's the Cape cobra, the forest cobra, the snouted cobra, and the Mozambique spitting cobra, they all come under the heading of Naja, which is the true cobra. Where the ringhals differs is that, first of all, it gives live birth, whereas the true cobras lay eggs.
Mm, wow.
It's got the same type of neurotoxic venom. It's got the same characteristic of rearing up, making a hood, and it spits its venom as well as the Mozambique spitting cobra does.
We just had the other day a cobra spit at one of the dogs and get it in the eyes. I didn't see it, but would that be a Mozambique cobra?
That'll be a Mozambique cobra in this area, yes.
Okay. Mm. So let's talk a little bit about the different kinds of venoms. You mentioned the neurotoxic.
Yes, your mambas, your three of your four cobras, your ringhals, these are neurotoxic. Neurotoxic affects the nervous system.
Which means what? What happens in the body?
It affects your muscles and nerves around the heart. It affects your respiratory system. And in the final stages, without treatment, you die of either heart or lung collapse.
Wow.
And how long does that take?
It depends on several circumstances. It depends on whether the snake that bites the victim has just fed, in which case a lot of its venom would have been used on the prey.
Hmm.
It also depends on the makeup of the person and the position of the bite. If the bite's on an extremity like a finger, your chances are pretty good of getting to assistance.
Mm.
If, of course, it's near a main artery or something, then you have a major problem. Mm. The quickest death that I've heard of from a black mamba, it's recorded in police files in Sabisa in Zululand, was approximately 4 minutes.
Wow.
But then the policeman was bitten on the side of the neck here, right next to a main artery. Your night adder, your puff adder, and your Mozambique spitting cobra, funny enough, are all cytotoxic. Now, cytotoxic bite is extremely painful. There's a lot of swelling, and it actually dissolves tissue.
Mm.
So you end up with a lot more physical problems. And if it isn't treated as quickly as possible, you could end up losing a finger, hand, arm.
Is that like gangrene?
That's gangrene sets in, yeah. It actually eats the tissue from the inside, which is, you know, not a pleasant. Pleasant. But it's a fairly slow-moving venom. So you have a better chance of getting to assistance.
Mm.
But getting the serum is essential as quickly as possible to save as much as you can.
Would that be like a rattlesnake, comparable to a rattlesnake bite?
Your western diamondback is cytotoxic. Your eastern diamondback, I believe, is more neurotoxic. So even in the same family, you get differences in venom.
Yeah, because in the United States, where I am, in the California area, we don't see a lot of snakes at all where I am because it's so urban. But in the Sierras, you hear about rattlesnake bites, and then it's, you know, a lot of tissue swelling.
Sure.
And so.
Yeah, that's cytotoxic. One of the worst bites that I've seen from your area is the water moccasin or cottonmouth.
Mm, that's in the south. Yeah.
That is also cytotoxic, and it's the results of a bite are horrific.
Mm.
Now, we have a bit of a problem because in a lot of the write-ups on American snakes, they don't talk about cytotoxic venom. They talk about either neurotoxic or hemotoxic. Now, we've divided it into three here: neurotoxic, hemotoxic, and cytotoxic.
Mm.
Now, the snakes here that have hemotoxic venom is the boomslang and the vine snake.
Mm.
Now, hemotoxic venom affects the blood. It's an extremely slow working venom. You could go for 4 hours before you actually show symptoms.
But you would know that you're bitten because
you would see
the...
But once the symptoms start, you start hemorrhaging from the bowels, internal organs, your nose, your eyes go bloodshot because all the little veins break. Yes, it's not a very pleasant venom. And if you've really reached the more or less the end of your tether, only a complete blood transfusion will save you.
Do you see a lot of those kinds of bites?
No. Fortunately, the boomslang and the vine snake are shy snakes. They'll rather give way. We hear about all sorts of hair-raising stories about our snakes. There's stories about mambas that chase horses and catch them. And
I've heard some of those. Cars. And
yeah. And, you know, this is nonsense. We haven't got any snake in South Africa that will attack you.
Not even a mamba. I've heard a black mamba is fairly aggressive, though. No?
He will also give way. If he's got an escape route, he will give way. The most aggressive of our snakes are the cobra family. Mambas give way. But if you corner a mamba, you've got a problem. So I've caught them here of 3.5 meters. Now that's a big snake.
That's we use feet and inches there, so that's about 10 foot.
That's about 10 foot, yeah. They average 8 to 9 feet. Once you get 10 feet and over, you get in a big snake.
And the bigger the snake, the more venom it can pump into you?
Not really, no, because they tend to control the amount of venom. Huh. But if it's cornered, it can end up biting you two or three times. So you're going to get quite a volume of venom. Yeah. But mambas are not anywhere near as aggressive as people make out. Mm. I've been told that they shoot across the top of sugarcane. This is nonsense. But a big mamba would be able to lift a third of its body off the ground. So when it's traveling, its head will be a third of the body off the ground. Then it goes down onto the rest of the body. And this is where people see the head going through long grass, and they think it's on top of the grass. It's not. The body is under the grass.
That's
on
the ground. Way it normally travels?
Yes. Yeah, so that's our venoms that we have in this area.
You're listening to herpetologist Garth Carpenter of the Ashburton Sanctuary in KwaZulu-Natal describing the various venomous snakes in this region. This is Raising Sand Radio on Stanford University's KZSU FM 90.1. I'm Susan Gallimore, and we're in South Africa for the next couple of weeks and bringing you views and voices from that region. Let's go back to Garth Carpenter and how he got started with snakes.
Now, most people feel like snakes are really creepy and, you know, get me away. I just don't want to be around a snake. And yet here you are. You have been fascinated with these creatures all of your life since you were 12 years old. Mm. How did that happen? And how did you overcome that sense of fear?
Okay, well, I've always been interested in wildlife. From a very young age, I was fascinated by ants. Mm. And from there, I went on to various other things, chameleons and lizards and... And then when I was about 12, I went for a walk in veld near our home, in the bush there, and I came across a puff adder. Now this was the first venomous snake I'd actually come across. So more by good luck than good judgment, I managed to catch it and put it into a old tin. And I brought it home. Now my brother is terrified of creepy crawlies. But I knew that my parents wouldn't be happy with this. Anyway, they did find out about it. I'd transferred it from the tin into a large plastic box, and this was under my bed. And the maid pulled it out, and I suppose being curious, she opened the lid, saw what was in it, went screaming around the house until my mother quietened her and asked what's wrong. No, she said, there's a big snake in the box under the bed.
You were at school.
I was at school. And when I got home, my mom phoned my father, and he came home as well, and they were all ganged up against me. So I decided, right, I'll sell the snake to the medical institute. Now, they milk snakes for serum. And I read in a paper that they paid 5 shillings, which is equivalent to 50 cents, for a puff adder. And 7 and 6 pence, which is 75 cents, for runcals. So I thought, you know, I could turn this into a business. So I used to go out every weekend into the bush, catch whatever snakes I could, catch a bus into town, and sell them to the medical institute.
Wow.
And that's how I started off. And being interested, I read up on them as well. And I spoke to people who were knowledgeable on reptiles. So I gained a lot of information that way. And then, of course, when I went into the bush as a game ranger, I was 18 years old. I mean, then it was paradise. I mean, there were snakes everywhere.
Mm.
So I caught for snake parks. I caught for private collectors. I caught for people who were exporting them. And
so you never had that kind of revulsion that so many people
no,
had.
No. Actually, I'm fascinated by people's fear of snakes. People have said to me, I'd rather meet a lion in the bush than a snake. This doesn't make sense. The lion's capable of eating you, the snake. I mean, there's no comparison. Then, of course, I did 2 years on Operation Noah, which was when they filled the Kariba Dam.
Let's just say the Kariba Dam is a huge, huge dam in what is now Zimbabwe.
Yes, it's on the Zambezi River. It's the border between Zambia and Zimbabwe.
And the falls, the Victoria Falls, are part of that river too.
Yes.
So it went up. They were started building it. When was that?
Oh, it was 1955 or six. And of course, as the water rose, it formed little islands all over the place, and these islands were crawling with wildlife because everything went onto them for safety, and of course snakes as well.
Interesting.
I spent 2 years rescuing the game off these islands.
Wow.
And catching the snakes as well.
What did they do with all of that game?
The game we used to take to the mainland and release it. But antelope especially suffer from shock. So about 30 yards from the actual mainland, we would drop them in the water. That would cool them down.
Interesting.
Because otherwise they tend to hyperventilate. And cools them down, and then we'd herd them onto the mainland and let them go.
If you're just tuning in, this is Raising Sand Radio on KZSU FM 90.1, Stanford University. I'm Susan Gallimore, talking today with Garth Carpenter of the Ashburton Sanctuary. I mentioned earlier that as a young girl of 12 or so, I went on a couple of trips with Garth Carpenter to retrieve snakes or collect other animals that were injured or simply considered pests by local humans. Garth Carpenter has spent all of his life with and around wild animals, and he continues to do that. Today we talk about his early years as a conservationist.
You were also in the bush for a long time as a hunter, weren't you?
Yes, I did 2 years safari work in Luangwa Valley in Zambia. I found that I wasn't as diplomatic as I should be with some of the clients. Some of the clients were completely trigger happy and wanted to shoot everything they saw, and that didn't go down well with me. And then they'd try and get more than they were licensed to, and that also didn't go down with me. So I did 2 years of that. It was an interesting experience, and I'm glad I did it. But after the 2 years, I thought, no, my life is rather back as a game warden. So I returned to game warden work.
So what are the issues that you have faced?
Okay, poaching. In Zambia, we had a different level of poaching. Included in that would be people who stole explosives of the mines, copper mines. And they would go and dynamite pools of water. Now, the concussion kills everything in that pool. And they would then take off the fish that they wanted and leave everything else. And if the pool was stagnant and wasn't running, it used to pollute the entire system. It was only when the rains came and cleared the pools. But by that time, a lot of damage had been done.
So the other animals in the pool would have been, so fish?
Fish, crabs, terrapins, whatever was in there,
crocodiles,
everything was killed from the concussion.
Wow.
Now, the problem there was you'd hear the explosion and you'd head off in that direction. You would catch up with the poachers and they turn around and throw a stick of dynamite at you. So it was like warfare. You threw yourself flat, hope you didn't throw yourself on the dynamite. It would go off, you'd get up and chase them again. And as some of them weren't reluctant to use a firearm either.
And the idea behind poaching is sometimes it's to sell animal parts?
Yes. One of the favorite things here with poaching is to make biltong, or I think you call it jerky, out of the meat, and also to sell the hides and skins. We recently caught a poacher here who'd shot a zebra.
In this area. The zebra was part of the park?
Yes, it was part of our conservancy.
Okay.
And we chased him, we caught him, and he said to us that he was going to make sausage and salami out of this thing. This is the zebra. And then we found out later that he had an order for a green zebra skin, which goes for about 3,000 rand. A treated zebra skin goes for anything up to 12,000 rand. Wow. So here again we come back to shooting for a skin to sell. That case is still ongoing. We caught some Indians here who'd shot an Inyala, which is protected game. They were sentenced to a very heavy fine. Beginning of last year, I caught two Indians out in Bishopstow who had shot two Inyala and Duiker. They were fined 20,000 rand each, lost all their firearms.
This week there was a picture of a rhinoceros with the two horns chopped off its face. I don't know if that was the wound that killed it, but it was dead.
No,
it was a huge animal.
Yeah, it was shot. Yeah.
Oh, it was shot. Yeah.
You see, today the poachers use AK-47s. They just stand there and riddle the rhino till it collapses.
So you can't. That's the only thing that they would use it is for that horn.
The horn, yes.
Mm. And not the skin.
No.
Is it still happening a lot?
We've lost about 80 rhino over the last 15 months. That's on private game farms, private reserves, and provincial and government reserves. You see, they used to poach mainly in Central Africa, Kenya, Uganda, Tanzania. Rhinos have become scarce there. So they're now coming down to our area. They started in Zimbabwe and they've virtually wiped out the rhino there. They're now coming into South Africa because this is probably the last stronghold of the rhino in Central and South Africa, or Southern Africa.
And they've been protected here, so they are
being protected. There's, you know, quite a number still.
Yeah. Now, there's two different kinds of rhino, as I recall, right? There's the white...
The white rhino, which is the larger of the two. And the black rhino. The white rhino is a grazer. It eats grass. The black rhino is a browser. It lives off the leaves of bushes. Mm. The white rhino has what we call a square lip. That's for cropping the grass. Mm. The black rhino has a overhanging lip so you can get the branches. The white rhino is fairly placid. The black rhino is inevitably aggressive. Now, the Zulus have a theory for this. They say that the white rhino eats grass, so keeps it placid. But the black rhino eats leaves of thorn bushes, and it eats the thorn bushes. And when it passes a motion, it's all the thorns that scrape its rear end and
put it in a bad mood.
And keep it in a bad mood.
If you're just joining us, this is Raising Sand Radio on KZSU FM 90.1, Stanford University. I'm Susan Gallimore, talking with Garth Carpenter of the Ashburton Sanctuary. Your kind of life is very unique, especially these days, isn't it?
I've had an extremely good innings in the bush. I've followed what I've always wanted to do. Mm. I've got experiences, or I've had experiences that I would never have had in any other sphere of life. I've hunted man-eating lion, rogue elephant, rogue buffalo, rogue hippo, man-eating leopard, and it's all added to my experience. And as I say, I've had a very rich life in the bush.
In the area that I'm in, there's all of these industries going up, and
unfortunately, this is a worldwide problem. The more people we have, the more industry we need to keep the country going. And the more people and industry that we have, the less wilderness we're going to have. Because farming is, especially in areas like the east, they keep on cutting down forest. And this is pushing the wildlife into small pockets. And because the pockets aren't large enough to sustain the wildlife, they're coming out and they're raiding the gardens. There you immediately get confrontation between the humans and the animals. And unfortunately, in many cases, the animals lose out. We have a problem with the population on our planet. Mm-hmm. And each year, our resources get less and less.
And yet, it's a conversation that it seems people are reluctant to have.
Well, it's not easy to go to people and say, right, you can only have one or two children. it's basic interference in their lifestyle.
Mm.
And most governments are reluctant to do this.
Mm-hmm.
But it is the only way that we are going to conserve our planet. It's worrying because going back to industry. Now, we have an electricity shortage in our country. And we've got vast reserves of coal. Now, coal is a problem as far as carbon emissions go. But they're now building more coal plants for our electricity.
Mm.
Now, again, to get to the coal, you've got to destroy the surface area, which is wilderness.
Mm-hmm.
So this is another problem.
Mm-hmm.
You see, once you interfere with the riverine bush, now the riverine bush is there for one reason. It's to contain the banks in floods.
Mm.
And once you destroy that, you loosen the banks and the floods wash the banks away. The river becomes wider and shallower. And in time, the river will dry up in winter. The only time you'll get water in those rivers is during floods. Now, this was in the past a problem where farmers would plow right down onto the river banks. And when the previous government found out what was happening, they brought in a law. Depending on the soil, whether it was soft or hard soil, you had to have between 50 and 100 yards of riverine bush you couldn't touch. It was there for one reason, to contain the rivers.
And people pretty much stuck to that.
Yeah. But today it's a different matter. Control is lacking, and we're having all sorts of problems.
Now, South Africa has extremely progressive environmental laws, but they're not able to implement them.
They can't implement them, and they can't monitor them. This is the problem here. We haven't got enough staff. Look at any department we've got, health, whatever, are understaffed. All our departments are understaffed.
Mm.
And the environmental department is low down on the list.
And yet it's a source of income because of the tourism, surely.
It is, but we have a problem here with areas that aren't being correctly managed. We have a problem here with crime. I mean, let's be honest about it and look at it as it is. And the wilderness areas that we've got are being encroached on by people or industry, mines, whatever. So, yes, we have a good constitution, we have good laws, and we haven't got people to monitor them.
Mm.
This is what it's all about.
And so, having spent your life really dedicated to the natural world, and you acknowledge that you've had a very wonderful and rich life, it must be a little bit on the heartbreaking side to see what's happening.
It frustrates me out of my bracket, quite honestly, because there's no reason for it. If the laws were correctly upheld, we wouldn't have all these problems. But it's not only South Africa, it's throughout Africa.
Mm.
And then, of course, you have things like civil wars in Africa. And for the armies and militia to be able to continue, they shoot game for provisions.
Yeah.
Another problem.
If you're just joining us, this is Raising Sand Radio on KZSU FM 90.1, Stanford University. I'm Susan Gallimore, talking with Garth Carpenter of the Ashburton Sanctuary.
We're on the edge of a city, and it's actually, as you mentioned, this is a conservancy. How big is the conservancy here?
The conservancy here is about approximately 6,000 to 7,000 acres.
So a nice size.
It's a very nice size.
Yeah, and so here we are on the edge of the city. So people from the city will call you up and say, Garth, I have a snake in a box under my bed.
Yes, definitely. I get a number of calls for larger snakes because people are more likely to notice them. Pythons, I get a lot of calls.
But would you find a python in the city?
No, but on the outskirts of the city.
Okay.
I caught one. It was about 7 foot. It had got into an aviary. I very often get called for puff adders, boomslang, and spitting cobras, also on the outskirts. Mambas don't tend to go into areas where there's too much movement. They are very nervous and wary snake.
Hmm.
It's only if you corner them, which is a problem, because we had a case here in Ashburton where a mamba had got into a headboard. It was quite an interesting call. This lady and her husband worked, and they had an 8-year-old daughter who had a speech problem. And every Wednesday afternoon, mother would take daughter to the therapist for a session. And on this particular Wednesday afternoon, there was a cancellation, and mother and daughter got in earlier than normal. Now, the maid had been telling them that there was a big snake in the house. And because they'd never seen it, they thought, ah, you know, big exaggeration, yes. Anyway, they got home earlier on this Wednesday to find the maid standing outside. Mother said to the maid, what's wrong? She says, the big snake is lying in the lounge. So mother cautiously opens the door just in time to see this long grey snake shoot down the passage into the bedroom. So she runs down after it and she closes the door. She phones me. So I get there. Now, I hate going through a bedroom. It's a very private room. Anyway, I looked under everything, behind everything, and nothing. But the windows were open. So I said, look, it's probably gone out the window. But if you see it again and it goes into a room in the house, somebody closes the door, and the other person, if there is another person, runs outside and closes the windows from the outside. So we know it's in the room. And that's fine. They go shopping on Saturday morning, get back about up past 11, maid's outside. Mother says, what's wrong? She says, the snake's in the house. It went into the kitchen and drank water out of their little dog's bowl, and it's now lying in the lounge. Mother opens the door. The snake's taking off down the passage into the bedroom. So she says to her husband, run in and close the door. And she ran around and closed the window. Phoned me up and she said, look, it's definitely in the room. So I get out there. I pull that room to pieces. I couldn't find it. And I'd looked behind the headboard, but it was fairly dark there. I pulled the headboard away from the wall. And there at the bottom, in the material, was this sort of lump. So I looked at it and I thought, well, I'm sure they didn't manufacture the headboard to have a lump in the bottom. So I prodded it with my toe. Now, a mamba has not got the normal hiss of a snake. It's more sort of a and I heard this. Now, the family was standing in the doorway. And I said to them, look, I think you should go out and close the door. Because if this is what I think it is, we're going to have a problem. And anyway, I prodded it until it came out. It was an 8-foot mamba. It went around the room with its head about 3 foot up, mouth open, going around. Yeah, I'm falling over the bed, which I'd moved. Everything was in a shambles. Anyway, I caught it.
So you catch it with the snake catching?
I catch it with a grab. Yeah. Take the head out the grab and put it in the bucket.
So they were actually sleeping with the snake.
Yeah.
That was its sleeping spot,
yes,
too.
Anyway, the family come back in. I said, right, you know, I've caught it, it's a mamba. The lady says, where did you catch it? I said, well, it's got into the material, the bottom yarn, the headboard. She said to me, what side? So I pointed to her. She says, that's my side. She says to her husband, take this out and burn it. He says, are you mad? He says, this cost, I don't know how much, but they started an argument. I said, well, look, the stitching has come away at the bottom. That's how it's got in. Maybe if you just stitched it up, it would. But I don't want to get involved in your domestic arguments. Now, this was just before the onset of winter. And that snake was looking for a place to hibernate. And it had got into the house, found this place, and being a diurnal snake, it was only coming out later in the morning and going to bed by the time they got home. So they didn't see it. But the sun, morning and afternoon sun, came in through the lounge windows. And when the days had warmed up, it was coming out, lining the sun in the lounge. But it was quite happily living there in the headboard.
Yeah, and you don't know how long it had been there.
From the first time the maid had mentioned it, it was about 10 days.
Mambas and other snakes, what about their mating rituals? They don't mate and then stick together or anything
no,
like that?
No, that is a fallacy. Snakes remain together during the mating period, which could be a couple of days to maybe a week.
Once a year?
Once a year. And then they split up. They do not remain in pairs. One of the fallacies about the mamba is if you kill one, its mate will come back.
Yeah, I hear that a lot.
Absolute nonsense. With all the mambas that I've caught, I should be sitting out in the garden waiting for hundreds of mambas to come to me. I mean, it just doesn't happen.
So what are the other sorts of fallacies about snakes that, I mean, I would have thought they would avoid houses.
Now, what often happens is they get into a garden and they disturbed by either dogs going for them or people, and they head for this first place that they think is cover, and it's sometimes through a door.
Mm.
So they get into the house. Now, this is a problem because to search a house for a snake is a day-long job. Could be anywhere.
Yeah.
The one spitting cobra we caught was in a washing machine. It had got up into the workings of the washing machine. We had to virtually dismantle the washing machine to get the cobra out. And
so someone had seen it go in
there. Had seen it go into the laundry. So at least we only had one room. You know, I left the owner putting his machine together again. And when I spoke to him later, he said, no, it's working okay, but he's got a couple of spare parts. So I don't know where they came from. You know, the bigger the snake, the more stories there is about it. The mamba is the largest venomous snake on the African continent. Well, the record was almost 14 foot. They average about 8-9 foot. It's an average. Once they get to 10 foot and over, it's a big mamba. The biggest one I've actually caught was at Kariba, which was 11 foot 8 inches. The next biggest I've caught was 11 foot 2 inches, and off to that, it was between 9 and 10 and then down.
So the other thing I've heard about mambas in particular is that they're territorial. They'll stay in a particular zone.
You'll find several, excuse me, snakes do that. Your python, many of your cobras, and the black mamba. The green mamba is an arboreal creature. It lives in trees and it travels from tree to tree. But your black mamba, yes, it's usually a hole in the ground, an old anteep, or under rocks, places like that.
If you're just joining us, this is Raising Sand Radio on KZSU FM 90.1, Stanford University. I'm Susan Gallimore, talking with Garth Carpenter of the Ashburton Sanctuary. Garth is a herpetologist and has spent his life dedicated to the creatures of our wild world. He is currently building the Ashburton Sanctuary outside Pietermaritzburg in KwaZulu-Natal, and he rehabilitates injured animals and wild birds and so forth. And if they recover from the injuries, he releases them back into the wild, which often is onto a 7,000-acre or so conservancy surrounding the Ashburton Sanctuary. The conservancy is a particularly South African institution monitored by local residents. I asked Garth Carpenter about crocodiles and a famous annual canoe race that takes place in this region of KwaZulu-Natal on the Umsunduzi and the Umgeni rivers.
There's a lot of arguments back and forth about these and crocodiles.
First, let's say that the Umsunduzi runs through the city of Pietermaritzburg.
Yes, and it joins up with the Umgeni. Now, it's basically the lower end of the Umsunduzi where it joins the Umgeni that you get the crocs. I've caught several along the river. People come and complain, and I go down and see what I can do. And the largest one that I've caught is about 10 foot. Now, a 10-foot croc is dangerous to man. Anything up to about 6 foot, you can ignore.
Mm.
They won't go for you. Once you get above 6-7 foot, you could have a problem. So I've only answered calls for the bigger ones. Years back, there were no crocodiles in the Mgani or the Msunduzi. My own views on this is that they are escaped from crocodile farms. There's a couple of crocodile farms right on the Mgani River. And when I spoke to one of the owners, he denied it. These crocs can't get out, this and the next thing. And then I caught one with a plastic tag in its tail.
Oh.
Now, it couldn't have been hatched with a plastic tag in its tail. So I went back to him and I said, this is your tag and this is your crocodile. Then he said, oh, well, maybe the odd ones got out.
Mm-hmm.
I think there's a lot more than the odd one getting out. And that is where I think they originated from. But the last panic call, there's one of about 7 foot down just above the Blue Lagoon in Durban. And that's where the final stages of canoe marathon is. And they've been trying very, very hard to trap it. I haven't heard whether they've been successful or not, but I've just left it. I've got more than enough work.
So these folks that are in the in this marathon, are they alerted that there are crocodiles?
Yes, they know there are.
And so that's just part of the decision that they make. And they're told what to do if they come into contact with one?
The one chap said to me, I come into contact when I'm going to be the fastest canoeist that's ever been known. But again, many of the crocs are small ones. When I say small, up to about 4 foot, 5 foot.
And how old is a croc of that size?
It depends on its diet. If it's all reptiles, if they have an area where there's plenty of food, they grow a lot quicker. Now, on average, 6 foot croc would be about 4 years.
So a 10 foot croc would be 8 to 10 years old?
Yeah, at least. Because as they get older, they get bulkier and their actual growth rate lengthwise slows down.
Mm. As an aside, the local newspaper announced a couple of days ago that two crocodiles over 10 feet have been sighted in the Blue Lagoon area of Durban that Garth Carpenter mentions here. It reports that traps will be set, but in the meantime, anybody spotting these crocs should report the sightings to the local police. There was another excerpt from the album Escape to Africa, capturing the sounds of African wildlife put to music. You probably recognize the sound here of lions roaring, and this introduces our next segment of today's show when I ask Garth Kopp to describe some of his more memorable experiences in his life dedicated to wildlife.
Well, I think the most interesting experiences that I've had is the hunting a man-eating lion.
That was in
Zambia. Zambia, and then in Malawi as well. Lions become man-eaters for a number of reasons. One that a person always hears about is it's an old lion or an injured lion that can't catch game. This happens in a minimum of cases. My own experience is that the lion breaks out of a game reserve or an area where there's game. And he wanders into an area where there are villages and livestock. Now, to a lion, a cow is just another animal. So it tackles a cow, pulls down the cow, and very often the herd boys go and try and drive it off the cow because the cow's dead, but at least they can get the meat. And depending on how hungry the lion is, he could either give up the cow and run, or you could turn on the herd boy. So where they turn on the herd boy, and especially if they eat some of the herd boy, they will then turn to hunting man. Now, all wildlife is afraid of man. They don't know that if they attack a man, whether they're going to get cleaned up or not. Once they find how easy man is to kill, then it's a different story. And I was told by a missionary doctor that a human's blood is saltier than an animal's because of our diet. And all wildlife crave salt. I mean, elephants travel for miles to these salt caves and everything else. And once they have fed off a human, it's the salt in the blood that attracts them.
And it's easy pickings.
It's easy pickings, yes. And now, lions are intelligent. And they'll often wander into a village at night. I'm talking about man-eaters. And they won't break into the first hut. They wander around the village. And having actually watched the lion one night, I've come to the conclusion, again, it's only my experience, I've come to the conclusion that a hut on its own doesn't mean anything to a lion. But the hut that he hears voices or movement that indicates to him that there's humans in the hut, that is the hut that he'll go for. So working on this theory, well, let's go back to the lion's method of killing. Where you get a pride of lions in an area, they have their own territory, and when they hunt, they'll kill in one place, then they'll move off several miles and kill again. The reason that they do this is where they've killed for a while, all the game is alert, so they'll move off, kill somewhere else, move off, and they actually work their area in a clockwise or anti-clockwise system. Now, some of the man-eaters keep to this system. Remember, they were brought up as ordinary game hunting lions. Something has turned them. And very often you'll find that they also work in an area in a circular, either clockwise or anti-clockwise way. And what I've done is I get into an area and I say, right, where was the last kill? The next kill? The one before that? Mm-hmm. And I will work out a pattern. And very often I've gone to where the last kill was here. I've gone to a village further on. And I've sat in an empty hut with a door open. Now, my theory, as I said, is that they wander throughout the village looking for something that is going to attract them. And the lion, being a cat, is curious. He walks around, he finds a hut with a door open. Now, he's not going to rush in. He's too wary for that. He walks round and round the hut. It's a bit of a nerve-wracking
I can imagine.
Method, because you're sitting with your back to the mud wall facing the doorway, and it's only a thin mud wall, and you actually hear the lion padding behind you because as he pushes his paw down on hard ground and he lifts it, goes like that, and you actually hear him. You're sitting there, your torch fastened onto the barrel of the rifle, watching the doorway. Now, it doesn't matter how dark it is, it's always darker inside the hut. And once your eyes become accustomed, you can always make out the doorway. You sit there and you wait until a shadow begins to fill the doorway. Because he's not going to rush in. You see the shadow begin to fill the doorway. That's the time to switch on the torch
and shoot.
And hope you don't miss. Although it's basically point-blank range, because the diameter of the average hut is about 12 to 15 foot. So you're shooting him, you know, basically here. And as soon as the light shines on him, he stands there like this and he blinks.
And that's what's going to save you.
And you've got to hit him. Yeah.
Huh. Wow. So when you're sitting with your back to this mud wall, he must be able to tell that there's a human being in there.
Well, in all these huts, there's the smell of humans. Yeah. So, you know, whether there's someone in there or not is basically immaterial, because the smell in the entire village to a lion is a human smell. But it's the open door that attracts him.
We also hear these stories of hyenas taking village kids. Is that true?
Unfortunately, in parts of Central Africa and Northern Africa, there's certain tribes that don't bury their dead.
Uh-huh.
They drag them out into the bush and leave them. And the hyenas feed off them. And whatever's left, they'll go and dig a shallow grave and chuck him in. If you're camping out there, to sleep out in a sleeping bag, for instance, very dangerous.
Huh.
Because whatever's lying on the ground, they're going to walk up and take a bite out of. And a hyena's got tremendous power in its jaws. I've actually seen them leave tooth marks in assegai blades. Now, that's a hard bite. That's a hard bite.
Wow. But then again, people are warned not to...
Yes, the colonial powers did quite a good job in stopping this type of ceremony or whatever you wanted to call it, and got the people to actually bury their dead.
Oh.
So there's very few places left in Africa where this actually happens.
This is Susan Gallimore of Raising Sand Radio on Stanford University's KZSU FM 90.1, talking today with Garth Carpenter. He has the Ashburton Sanctuary, which is in KwaZulu-Natal in South Africa. If you would like to know more about the sanctuary and how you can ensure wild animals are cared for and rehabilitated, send me an email at susan@raisingsandradio.org, and I'll be happy to put you directly in touch with Garth Carpenter. And you can learn from him about the animals he works with, and also, if you want to get more involved, how you can do that. The day I visited the sanctuary, there was an Egyptian goose, which is a protected bird, with a wing injury, a duiker that had been badly burned when poachers hunting it set fire on the grass in order to flush the small buck from the thick vegetation. There were also three stunningly beautiful herons and other small creatures that had been wounded by poachers. Again, if you want to know more about the Ashburton Sanctuary, email me at susan@raisingsandradio.org, and I'll put you directly in touch with Garth Carpenter of the sanctuary. Again, this is just outside the city of Pietermaritzburg in KwaZulu-Natal. And that's our show for today. As usual, all views and opinions are those of the host and guests and not KZSU or Stanford University. Tune in again next week to listen live on Pacific Time from Mondays from 2 to 3. At Stanford University's KZSU FM 90.1. If you want to listen live and you're out of the area, you can listen via streaming from our internet website, that is raisingsandradio.org, or you can simply download the entire show at your convenience, again from our website, raisingsandradio.org. You can also download any of our previous shows from that website, raisingsandradio.org, or email me at susan@raisingsandradio.org to comment on any of our shows or suggest topics for future shows. We'll go out with another excerpt from the album Escape to Africa, with Four Jackson and Jill putting African wildlife sounds to music.